Welcome to the Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. So this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy, and I'm really excited to have Richard Yan, the COO of Veet Labs, on the show, as well as the host of the Blockchain Debate podcast. I know Richard because I've listened to the Blockchain Debate podcast, and lots of times when you listen to more shows of the podcast, you almost feel like you know the host. And so I reached out to Richard, and I'm I've been listening to it, and I've been I engage with him on Twitter and started up chats with some of the people who are on the show. And so then I was like, you know what? Let's have you on the show. For the listeners, it's a great podcast because he frames a lot of issues in terms of a debate, which is a different way of learning. He has some really great guests. It's a great way to do sort of a deep dive and sort of think about things from different angles. So, Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
Let's talk a bit about you and your background and what got you into, what brought you to Veet Labs and to start the Blockchain Debate podcast.
Okay. Yeah. So I got into crypto around 2018. I got my first Bitcoin actually a lot earlier than that, but didn't really pay close attention to it. And I actually sold a little bit too early. But yeah, in 2018, I was connected with my current co-founders for Veet Labs through a family friend. At the time, I was working in fintech space in Silicon Valley. And I knew that crypto, that was in 2018, crypto has already started cooling off a little bit from the 2017 bull run, but it was all over the news. So if you're familiar with the 50 touch points theory, if you learn about a product 50 times through 50 different venues, chances are you're going to make a decision about buying it at some point. So I think the tipping point for me was that I was introduced to people that are trying to start this project called Veet, and they were actively looking for collaborators from the business side. My two co-founders were technocrats. So I started learning and really sort of went down the rabbit hole. And that's how we got started. So Veet Labs, we are a layer one public blockchain smart contract platform. And I can get into how we're different later on. But to answer your other question about why I started the Blockchain Debate podcast. So I started in 2019, which is sort of, continuation of the bear market. At the time, after having been in the industry for about a year, I felt that the entire industry was going through some kind of collective soul searching, right? Some of the earlier promises of blockchain weren't necessarily fulfilled. There was no active DeFi at the time, for instance. And I think that the store of value narrative for Bitcoin very much also rested upon the strength of its price, right? Because social consensus is a very big component of the success of something trying to be money or trying to be store of value. So I felt that there was a need for me, at least personally, to understand what's going on. And I was listening to a lot of podcasts. I felt that there was a lot of one-way communication. And in general, sometimes projects overmarket themselves, but on podcasts, the host generally does not challenge the source of information. I felt that, but on Twitter, on the other hand, there's lots of fights, right? People fervently believe different things, but it was also not the right medium for long-form serious discussion. So I felt that the space was probably screaming for some kind of debate podcast, and that's why I launched it.
Well, great. And I warned you a little bit about this ahead of time, a personal event that shaped your values, your worldview, something that's sort of a singular event that in your life.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I could tie a singular event to why I value the things I do in crypto, but I
think it doesn't have to relate to crypto.
Yeah. But I think that maybe the singular event is immigration to the US and while retaining a very strong root, a strong connection to my cultural roots in China. So I'm actually the host of yet another podcast called Chinatown 2.0.
Right.
I think Chinatown 2.0, the phrasing very much captures the state of my being. So I live in the US and I think and talk like an American person, but I think I'm also actually very bicultural. if I were to go visit China, I think I could easily assimilate, not only on a language level, but also in the cultural, in the cultural level. My two co-founders are from China and they're based in China. And neither of them has actually been to the US before, and they don't really speak great English. But when collaborating with them, I recognize that there's a special kind of bond, and it's very difficult to explain. But at the same time, I feel very at ease when I talk to my American friends. So in any case, I think that the singular event would probably just be this immigration to the US while retaining a strong connection to my cultural roots. I'm very happy to go into a little bit more. I feel maybe being a little bit too generalized. And by the way this is related to crypto is that China and US are arguably two of the biggest players in this space, and probably not just in crypto, but in finance, in tech, in social political matters. So I feel very lucky to be sort of at the intersection of these clashes and perhaps optimistically collaborations between the two cultural forces in this industry that I'm in.
Which province in China did you immigrate from?
Guangdong, so Shenzhen.
I've actually, have you been there?
Have I? Sorry, no, I moved from there.
Oh, you? So, I mean, since you moved, of course.
Oh, yeah,
have
yeah,
you
yeah.
been there? No, been I just immigrated from there. I mean, since you immigrated.
Yeah. How have you immigrated? But I was 15 years old. So I came here for high school. And then the longest I've been back was maybe 2 months during summer vacation. But since I started working, and I've only been back maybe a few times, and each time just no more than a few weeks.
Yeah, I was actually in Shenzhen in 1987.
Okay.
So, and I'm sure it's changed a lot since that time.
Yeah, it's a little bit different.
it's a little bit different.
I mean, but you know, the other interesting thing is that I'm on social media quite a bit now, and there's a lot of information that you can capture over Twitter, for instance. I think if I were to live on the ground in Shenzhen in an apartment, I probably would not have experienced the drastic change and the myriad information flow just by being locally. Being in the cloud actually exposes me more to the cultural experience in a way.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. So could you tell us maybe a little bit about Viet Labs and, you know, what it is and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Yeah. So we started Viet as an addition to the smart contract ecosystem. So Ethereum really started revolutionizing things by introducing smart contracts, but it suffered from multiple problems. Essentially, scalability is a big problem. And there are many other public blockchains that have been born to try to capture the Holy Grail. And Viet is one of them. I would say that we have gone through three phases. We've gone through two phases and we're on phase three. So the first phase is to launch the public blockchain with an alternative design that would lower the fees and increase throughput. And the second, and our mainnet is already launched as of 2019. So we've done that part. The second phase is trying to prove that this chain works well with a industrial strength DApp build on it. So we built a decentralized exchange called VietX, and it is functional. It's been working since 2019. We have a token associated with it with which you can receive proceeds from the exchange. And the way you earn the token is by trading on the exchange. So it was really sort of a early form of liquidity mining or usage mining. That's the phase two. Essentially, we started with a toy project. We thought that would be interesting to show people how well the chain would work. But we've been accumulating users, and we felt that this is actually becoming a much more serious application. It's no longer just a toy. So we have to continue to operate it and to expand upon the various ways developers can interact with it to make it more powerful. And the third thing we're trying to do right now, the third phase, is something called Viet Bridge. What we've discovered from operating VietX is that it's a decentralized exchange, but it is only a true decentralized exchange for assets issued on the Viet chain. So how do you support assets outside the Viet chain on our exchange and facilitate trustless transfers? So we thought about many different ways to do it. And ultimately, VBridge is our answer to that question. How do you create a trustless way of cross-chaining other assets onto the VChain so those assets can subsequently enjoy the trustless transaction process, trustless and performant transaction process on VTEX? So we're currently in phase three, and VBridge is what we call it. So those are the different cycles that we have gone through. And I'm happy to get into like how VEET is different at a layer one. So viewers of the podcast might be familiar with another project called Nano. It is a DAG-based project. It has a ledger paradigm called Block Lattice. So essentially, instead of having one chain that represents a ledger, every single account within Nano has its own chain. So that chain will capture the transaction between set account with external accounts. And so the process of updating the ledger is very much asynchronous. Like, for example, if you are Alice and you're trying to send money to Bob, you just have to change your own chain to indicate the fact that you are now sending money to Bob. And on Bob's side, they will be changing their chain in response to what's happening from Alice's side. So instead of waiting 10 minutes to add transactions from mempool into a block and then subsequently building the one single blockchain longer and longer, now you have many different chains operating asynchronously. So you can think of VEET as having been inspired by Nano, but added smart contract on top of it, added anti-spamming mechanism, and added a consensus algorithm in the form of delegated proof of stake. So VEET, the token, gets rewarded to the snapshot block producers, what we basically call the supernodes, in incentivizing the supernodes to secure the network in turn. In terms of anti-spamming, we have a staking model. So essentially, if you want to send a small low throughput, right? So if you just want to send small amount of transactions per second, you can do that without actually owning any VEET at the moment. But if you want to increase that, so the VEET price action was very strong at the beginning of this year. Lots of people were trying to get in on the action, but couldn't execute transactions unless they stake a certain amount of VEET. And then their quota, essentially the network resource that they will have to allow them to send more transactions, that will go up. So the staking model effectively says, if you try to spam the network, you're going to need to hold VEET. And the more you try to spam, the more VEET you need to hold. So that essentially serves as some kind of throttling mechanism. Then the smart contract part, Nano does not have, and we added it. And we have a programming language called Solidity++. And the smart contracting capability is now possible on the system.
So just for the listeners, do you want to kind of break down the proof of stake model? And also, I'm familiar with Nano. Nano sort of got a bit of a lift in the last few months, but I wasn't aware, like, the representatives that you're talking about, are those like light nodes? Because presumably, I mean, I don't know what the incentive would be to operate a full node for Nano, or is that essentially the problem? Like, you could only operate a full node, but why would you do it?
Yes. So we use in terms of consensus algorithm, we use delegated proof of stake, so not proof of stake. So it's more similar to the EOS model. Essentially, you have a number of supernodes, and you need to stake a certain amount of VEET in order to qualify. So you need to be a full node first. And then if you stake a certain amount of VEET, currently set at 1 million VEET, then you have the opportunity of becoming a snapshot block producer. You would take turns to snapshot blocks, in essentially blessing the ledger. So the way we have it set up is that the top 20, so each snapshot block producer receive votes from the community, right? Votes are in the form of VEET. So these are not VEET spent to vote, right? It's just indication of that you would vote for somebody. And the more VEET you have, the more you could vote. So you rank order all the snapshot block producers. In any given round of 75 seconds, 25 snapshot block producers are selected to bless the ledger and in return receive their block rewards. And then these 25, there's an algorithm that effectively says the more votes you have, the more likely you will be part of that set, even though it's not guaranteed.
All right. And so to take a step back, just for the listeners, can you walk us through proof of stake and how the delegated proof of stake model differs from the regular proof of stake model? I mean, I think you indicated for the delegation, it's the vote. And right. So that's that voting effectively is the delegation part, or is it something else?
Yeah. So our CEO had a good tweet. Proof of stake is democracy and delegated proof of stake is representative democracy. So essentially with proof of stake, anyone can become a validator. And to become a validator, you need to stake a certain amount of your coins. And depending on the protocol, you might get some staking yield. Generally, you do. And the staking yield comes from the fact that you are basically blessing the ledger. And to the extent that the amount of yield, the amount of staking reward you receive is proportional to the amount of stake that you have, right? So that's proof of stake. But delegated proof of stake basically says that the problem with proof of stake is a matter of scalability. If you have many different validators and you're trying to get many of them to come to consensus within a short period of time, that might not be easy. So in fact, this is why ETH is trying to move to ETH2. So if you can't get a group of people to agree to each other in a very short time, let's separate them into these different groups called shards, right? And then maybe each shard will have its own group of getting some kind of consensus. So instead of doing that, but the problem is that now you have an issue with communication between the different shards. So instead of trying to deal with that, we decided that maybe it's better to just limit the number of nodes that can bless the network or to control or to ensure the integrity of the network. But instead of doing a federated design, which basically says you would have a group of super nodes that are set in stone and no one can supplant them, and or you have a very difficult process of replacing each member, we basically set up a delegated proof of stake, which means it is a consortium of nodes that can make decisions, but they rely on votes. And essentially the community, and if there's any kind of bad behavior or there's just not enough uptime from certain participants, then they can get voted out by the community. And this is inspired by EOS.
Interesting. I know that on the Blockchain Debate podcast, we talked a bit about the decentralization trade-off, right? So obviously there's, and we'll start really basic. So we can start with why decentralization is important, but also what are the limitations of decentralization? And just to sort of frame it a little bit for the listeners, when you have a proof of stake network, you know, the idea is that you're decentralizing the administration, the validation of the network, of the transactions on a network. That has a decentralization aim, but also a validation aim. But sometimes, you know, there are some debates as to whether you can do things like increase transactions per second or the limits of decentralization in terms of what it means to the operation of the network. And like if something goes wrong, centralization, some degree of centralization, you know, a completely decentralized network may be slower to respond. But I'll let you pick it up from there. Or correct me, you know, feel free. I don't care. It's my podcast, but you can tell me I'm wrong.
No, I think you're striking the right notes there. So essentially, if we're only talking performance, centralized systems work better than decentralized systems. And essentially, the more centralized a system is, the easier it is to operate the system at scale, right? If you think about things such as even updating the software. If you have a decentralized set, for instance, with Vite, every time we need to do a hard fork, we need to contact all the super nodes, get at least 2/3 of them to agree to update the software. And if we were just serving a website from our AWS server, we could do that perhaps within a day, whereas with the super node hard forks, that process could take a week or so. So this is basically one way to illustrate how centralized systems perform better than decentralized systems. And then of course, there's also just having all the nodes agree, syncing within the network. That would also take a while. But with centralized systems, you don't have that problem. With a server client model, the server tells what the clients do, right? With a P2P model, you don't have that server. And then you need to get sort of a quorum of the clients to agree with each other. And that's much harder. But why am I saying this? What's my point? The point is that decentralization is more about censorship resistance, right? The problem is that if you were to have one centralized system that effectively executes, that decides what the network should look like, I mean, you're sort of relying on a benevolent dictator, right? And if you have a benevolent dictator, I mean, sometimes even benevolence is difficult to gauge. I mean, this is also subjective, but suppose even if we can come to consensus as to whether a dictator is benevolent or malevolent, you don't always get a benevolent dictator, right? Or the dictator could get captured by some other force. So the single point of failure could cause problems. That's why decentralization matters, even though it sacrifices performances somewhat. So Vitalik proposed the scalability trilemma of scalability, security, and decentralization. And it's very difficult to not sacrifice certain attribute if you want to optimize for another. And in the Vite design, we essentially decided that, okay, there's Bitcoin and there's Ethereum. Bitcoin is very decentralized. Ethereum is very decentralized. But they are decentralizing by sacrificing certain other things. Maybe there are use cases out there that will call for a slightly less decentralized and slightly less decentralized version, but have very high throughput, very high scalability. And that's the design that we came up with. There's a few other projects out there that have also tried to optimize for scalability while sacrificing other things. And I think their main mandate there is also just to basically satisfy certain use cases not currently addressed by Bitcoin and Ethereum.
So before even getting maybe a little bit further into what I call the network structure, and I don't mean it in a, like, I was trying to frame it before, and I was like, it's sort of like I come from a market structure background. And this is more like network structure, but not like network structure in terms of network architecture, like network structure in terms of how the components of the ecosystem and how they act together, like to what you said, the scalability, security, and decentralization. But before even sort of getting into that, you know, we talked about light nodes, we talked about full nodes, we talked about super nodes, and there's probably some other flavors of nodes. So for the participants, maybe just to give a what is on the different flavors of the nodes.
Sure.
Great.
Okay. So I would say the difference between all these different nodes is a matter of self-sovereignty, maybe responsibility. So let me explain that, right? So when you have a network of nodes or a network for blockchain, what are you trying to do with it? What's the essence of this thing, right? The essence is that you are trying to get the network to agree to a set of facts, right? So at the very basic level, the set of facts would be who owns what, right? And then beyond just a matter of monetary value, you could also have who said what, a set of information transfer or data transfer. And you want the entire network, you want a big part of the network to agree to a certain set of facts that's immutable, right? So now the question is, if you are a participant in this network, you are a node, and you try to know the state of this network, there's different ways to do it. So you could be a light node. In this case, you basically don't have the entire ledger in place. Maybe you have only parts of the ledger. Maybe you have pruned the history of the ledger. And then you have a full node, which basically has the entire ledger in place. Once you sync to the network, you don't rely on any kind of archive from anyone, right? You go from the Genesis block and you validate every single transaction that has ever occurred, right? And then you maintain the entire ledger on your as a local copy. And then the super node, or what we call snapshot block producer, essentially is a full node, but has the responsibility of blessing future ledgers. So it's active, whereas the other nodes are passive. The other nodes are I should say the light nodes are definitely passive. They're observers. The full nodes, they are semi-passive in the sense that they actually also are like a light node, except they maintain full copy of the ledger to ensure resiliency of the network, but they also validate transactions. So in the event that invalid transactions get propagated in the network and they're trying to find their way to the super nodes to be validated, these full nodes can screen out, can filter away these invalid transactions before they find their way to the super nodes, to basically reduce throughput of useless transactions in the network. And the responsibility of Snapshot Block Producer, or the super node, is to bless transactions, order transactions, and in return, they get paid. So yeah, so I think the different nodes in this network play different roles along the spectrum of trust and also responsibility.
And so I know that, you know, the super nodes, I'm not feeding this to you because I'm trying to promote Vite Labs. I'm not trying to not promote it. But in the context of decentralization, and you mentioned the tragedy of the commons, you know, right. One thing that I wonder about is, as we develop a lot of these different networks that rely on these light nodes or the full nodes, you know, certain networks are going to be very resilient, you would assume, over time. Like, I know for Ethereum, recent numbers indicate that the number of nodes are actually decreasing. But there is a view that, you know, there's still like, what, 7,000? Is that something? I don't know.
When I last looked at it.
Right. And it's gone down. Some people say it's, well, because they're going to Ethereum 2 and that the model is changing. But 7,000 is still, you know, you still have big entities that are doing it, presumably, and it's a fairly resilient network. But then you start to move away to some other networks. And at some point, the dependency on a smaller group of nodes could potentially be problematic for that protocol at a point in the future, particularly to your point, if they're not incentivized. And what happens if you've created this sort of brilliant decentralized structure that works great when the market's going up, but when things are sort of bouncing along, people are just like, well, you know, what do we do with it now? And it just sort of like, maybe the node operators aren't as engaged. Maybe it creates breaks in the network. I guess, what happens in those cases?
Right. So it's a great question. I think this boils down to, how do you incentivize full nodes to keep going when there's no direct incentive for full node operators? I think to answer this question, we need to step back a little bit and understand why full nodes are important in the first place. If they're not important, then this question is moot, right? Then just let it be. It doesn't matter, right? But the reason why full nodes are important, I think there are a few different reasons. Number one is, as I was saying earlier, they keep copies of the ledger. So in case of collusion at the miner, validator, supernode level, these full nodes essentially can reject copies, bad copies of the ledger, and ensure integrity of the network. They can revolt, essentially. And the second reason why full nodes are important is because they help route transactions. Well, actually, sorry, that's the third one. The second reason is they help screen out invalid transactions, so the network is not flooded with invalid transactions. They're like another set of gatekeepers that make sure that, you know, invalid transactions don't take up the valuable bandwidth. And the third reason is just that if you have a light client that just wants to trust some full node somewhere, right? But the fact that you have a full node close to you geographically, or just more easy to access from a network perspective, helps, right? So if somebody wants to trust the full node, you know, if I'm in Singapore and I want to trust the full node right on closer to me, then I could do that. Whereas if you don't have the full nodes around, then you might not have that sort of convenience. And the other thing about full nodes is that they are generally, they have less requirement on the hardware and the bandwidth than the super nodes. The uptime requirement is not as high. So even though they have a reduced set of functionality, they're also cheaper to run. So that's why if you are a light client, you might find it easier to connect to a full node, just because it's easier for you to identify a full node that's cheaper to run. Anyway, so ultimately, I think full nodes are important, right? Now, a lot of protocols have not been set up to properly incent the full nodes to be around. So Vite, the way we're handling things right now is that we have a separate fund, an ecosystem fund, where we basically pay out rewards for full nodes. So depending on your uptime, you know, you receive a certain amount of rewards. And I would say that in good times, when prices are going up, even during the bull market, without this kind of incentive, I think that it's hard to for someone to justify why they should be the marginal operator, right? Like, let someone else take care of this. This is really just tragedy of the commons. I would say that maybe one other possibility is to set up some sort of insurance fund, right? So with projects that have a treasury denominated in their own coins, during a bull market, they can set aside a certain amount that they can subsequently sort of dip into for the bear market in order to incentivize the full nodes to continue running in bad times. I don't think that I have seen a great solution at this moment, extra protocol, outside of the protocol level, to incentivize full nodes to keep running. So I think the other way to resolve this is if you are a active user of the network, you are incentivized to run the full node yourself, not just for the value of the portfolio of your coins, right? Not just for your bag, but the fact that you want to validate your transaction and make sure your transaction actually gets placed into the ledger in a timely manner, right? So if you're a merchant, for example, operating on VPay, or if you are we have a DEX, right? So if you are trying to get your transaction through, you could theoretically be interested in running a full node to facilitate that as well. Yeah, so I think I've been going on and on, but I think the short answer is that I haven't seen a great in-protocol solution for incentivizing full nodes, but I think it's also not just a purely, it's not like we can only rely on people trying to serve the greater good in helping to run full nodes. If you happen to be an active network user, if you are incentivized to run the full node just to make sure that your transaction gets validated and entered into the ledger in a timely fashion.
Right. And so just to pull on it, I know you're like, God, Eric, you're really like taking me down this hole. It's difficult questions, right? But actually what's interesting is that what inspires me is that your network seems to have done more to try to account for this. And I guess the question is, it's like, you know, and it's kind of funny because right now I'm working with Wyoming on their DAO statute a bit. And I've sort of raised this notion of a zombie DAO or a Franken DAO, right? Meaning what happens when, I mean, this debate about decentralization touches a lot of different corners, right? And if a DAO is set up to be, let's say it's fully algorithmic, which is a term that was used, that you can elect to be fully algorithmic. Me and a bunch of others have objected to it, and now it's being addressed as more of a continuum, because what happens when fully algorithmic doesn't work, right? If like, you know, we've done whoop-de-doo, we've got decentralization, and then something goes wrong. Well, okay, how do we fix it? I don't know. It's fully decentralized, you know, like there's no the governance model is fully algorithmic, so it's a machine, Terminator, I don't know, but it's you know, crazy stuff, and it's not that dramatic. You can have somebody running a company who's also a zombie. He's like, you know, just a bad person and stealing money, so it's different problem, but a problem nonetheless. And so the question is, in that case, what I've posed to them, in many ways it relates to this as well, which is what happens when there are certain dependencies in a decentralized system, or there are certain dependencies in a fully algorithmic model. What happens when those dependencies, you know, break, right? There's a lot of protocols, and I'm sure this is going to happen at some level where the node operators, to your point, like Nano, everybody might be like, oh yeah, you know, great, you know, common good. And I hate to pick on Nano because I know there's tons of people who support it on Twitter, but there is a flaw in a dependency on people always acting in the common good, because people's interest wanes, you know, and that sense of community may be de-channeled elsewhere, and node operators may not be incented. So what happens when, like, in a network where you're depending on others to do it, right? Let's say everybody's depending on the node operators to do their thing. Network's great as long as the node operators do their thing, but the node operators aren't being incented, so they're not doing their thing. And maybe there's less node operators, and maybe that exposes it to security issues. And, you know, there's different terms for, like, what happens when you, like, you know, network takeover or what have you, but also just sort of these, I guess, what, Sybil attacks or what have you on the network.
Right.
What do you think happens in that context? I know you don't have all the answers, but you've thought about it. So what do you think happens?
Well, so I feel like you're touching upon two points. With regard to the DAO algos and with regard to incentivizing people to serve the greater good in the context of full node runners, right?
Right.
So I think these are two separate things. I think the first one, unfortunately, I think the notion of code is law is an asymptotic situation. I don't think we can, it's like utopia, right? So you set up some system and you preset the rules, right? And the rules can't really be changed because otherwise it just becomes a hybrid system, right? Like you could say, oh, well, we could upgrade it. We could have you know, regular updates to it. But then it just, the adjudication is not by some code. The adjudication is still done by humans, right? So I think that code as law is not a sustainable situation. I mean, if you think about what had happened with Ethereum, if we had gone the way of just allow the DAO attack to be legitimized, I think the Ethereum ecosystem would not have flourished by as much, because so much Ethereum basically were drained into the hands of very few as a result of that attack. Yeah, so I suppose that serves as one counterfactual to the code is law narrative. And
yeah, and I'll have to drop a, I think the ZKP podcast, they had a number of episodes with some of the guys in the trenches. I'm forgetting the guy's name. He's a rock star now. But, you know, what went on with that hack and all the work that they had to do to try to get ahead of the hackers. I mean, it's like, it's crazy, but wouldn't make a good movie, but certainly makes a good podcast.
Right. Anyway, so I think so regarding the DAO design and whether a DAO can elect to be fully algorithmic, I think there's always going to be some kind of social layer to the work that we're doing with blockchain. There's also always going to be some kind of human coordination as to how we make decisions. I think fully automated networks with zero human intervention, eventually, I think that kind of trade-off is not going to work well in the long run, because sooner or later, you're going to run into one of these DAO attack things. So I think philosophically, the adjudication process needs to be more flexible as a result. And I did a debate for this between Edmund Schuster and Emin Gunsirer on tokenization and smart contracts. And Edmund is a lawyer. He is a professor at London School of Economics. And his argument is that code can't be law. Smart contracts ultimately require some kind of court proceedings. It needs to be compatible with existing laws, right? Because if it's not, I mean, it doesn't matter what the code says. And but the problem is that the framework of law also changes. Certain things that are considered okay might not be okay, and certain over time, and then vice versa, right? So if you have right, so if you just go by that, like, what if a smart contract does something that's considered legal today, it becomes illegal? Then what do you do, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, my view on, I listened to the episode and it was at, you know, I think a lot of that debate was at a time where there was a view that smart contracts were contracts, right? That they actually were contracts. And the appropriate way to view contracts, a smart contract, in my view, is that they're neither smart nor actual contracts. They're really, they're if-then statements that have inputs, you know, that come from external generally, or there's some sort of event and it creates an output, but it's not a contract per se. Like I like, for example, I see smart contracts as being very valuable, like it's say an insurance contract or anything which requires some sort of automatic execution. Like, hey, if the price drops below this, then, you know, take the collateral. I mean, we saw that, you know, last week with the drop, you know, like DeFi protocols were just pulling the collateral back instantaneously. And that's the way it's supposed to work. But it's a mechanism. It's not the actual contract, but it represents a component of a contract whereby certain things occur. It may be executing a component of a contract or an agreement between two parties that if an occurrence happens or if an event happens or if some data triggers the appropriate response, then something occurs. To me, it's part of an overall contractual framework. It doesn't actually replace the contractual framework. There still is an agreement between parties that has to almost precede it. Like I put my money, like I borrow money from a decentralized platform. I go to SushiSwap and I go into Aave and I deposit collateral and I borrow and the market drops. But by that deposit, there's sort of an agreement effectively that I understand, you know, or I should understand. People could say, well, you know, did you read the terms or did you sign anything? No, but by putting your money up as collateral in that fashion, it represents an agreement that you understand that if it drops below a certain level, you could lose all your collateral. That's the contract. But the smart contract component itself is the execution of that broader contractual relationship that precedes it or surrounds it, but is not actually the fundamental contract itself. I don't know if that makes
it. Yeah. So you're saying the smart contract is a technical implementation, but it still needs to follow regulations, right? So I think there will be moments when there are no regulations in place. And that's when I think smart contracts will become valuable. Because the thing is, suppose you have...
Well, not even regulation per se, like the rule of contract law, right? So it's not like contract law isn't necessarily regulated in the sense that like the SEC or there's some sort of regulatory framework. You know, the contracts are enforced pursuant to the laws of any jurisdiction, right? And then there's some overall premises. There's a law of contracts, which is really based on precedent that goes back hundreds of years and, you know, what constitutes an agreement between the parties and all that component. That can change by jurisdiction. And then there's sort of this overarching view. I mean, you have like the UCC and you have different sides of it, but it's not a regulation, like even just like me and you, like I say, hey, you know, we're going to do this podcast. And you say, okay, well, that's not really a contract. I'll send you one VEET, you know, to do the podcast. And you're like, okay, well, then it's like a question of enforceability. But anyway, I know I went off on a bit of a tangent there, but.
Right. So, I mean, but the point I was trying to get into though, is that when there's no laws in place, I think that smart contracts play a very big role, right? Just think about it this way. The earlier ICOs, if you were to try to buy ICO of a project launched by some people in Romania, for instance, I mean, you don't know how the laws work there. And you have no knowledge of the credibility of these Romanian project members. But ultimately, you have no protection. Essentially, I have no recourse if you were to get scammed, right? Like if I were to do this in, let's say, what's a country with great rule of law? Let's say America, right? And if it's a security offering or it needs to be exempt, right? If you were to market to retail, ultimately there's protection, there's recourse. It might take a while for you to reclaim your funds through the court systems and whatnot, but ultimately there's a path, right? If you're trying to buy something from Romania or from, you know, people in, you know, a country, it's just places that just transactions with individuals they're totally unfamiliar with under legal frameworks that might or might not be present. I think the code is super important. So you can examine the code and you can agree on what you will actually be doing as a result. And it's the same thing with decentralized exchange, right? So lots of centralized exchanges do shady things, right? You front run your clients, you are not properly custodying your clients' funds, you have all kinds of deposit or withdrawal problems. So, and the reason they're able to do that is because they're not regulated, right? So if it's a centralized exchange operating out of, let's say, Russia or something, and you as a Canadian person try to trade on it, there's nothing that secures your funds, right? So you're putting trust in the operator of that exchange. But if it's a decentralized exchange, then you can audit the code and you can have a better understanding for what you're getting yourself into. Now, of course, there's a counter argument in that most people that use DEXs don't look at the code, right? They don't have the expertise, they don't have the time. So there's also a matter of faith that you're placing in the developer of that smart contract, right? And every time this code gets updated, are you supposed to go and check the updates? But I would say on balance, it's reasonable to say that if a system is fully transparent and ready to be audited, the fact that people, you'll see this ecosystem of sort of grassroots effort, right? Or community experts that pop up to look at the code and to basically bless or validate the inner workings, right? Whereas if a system is completely closed and non-transparent, you don't even have that option.
Right. And I would take it a step further that I would think the best protocols, and it's also something that I'm raising to Wyoming. And I, you know, it's a question of flexibility, but code auditing, like the DAO statute in Wyoming is not going to mandate code auditing because they're trying to make it flexible. You know, an LLC doesn't require, you form an LLC in Delaware, you're not required to do an audit. So the view would be, why would I become a DAO then in Wyoming if I had to do an audit? But yet, I believe that there should be a statement that says whether or not a provision has been made for third-party code auditing. And what I would love to see in the space is just, and again, it's not going to be right for everybody, but I would love to see more greater push for code auditing as part of, you know, we're a DAO and we've gotten our code audited and we've made provisions that every year, you know, we're going to get this company in to do a third-party code audit to make sure that what we say we're doing is actually what we're doing. Because absent that, there's always a risk that, to your point, you know, it's one thing if the code is free and open. It's another thing when the code isn't. But in either case, people may not review it. And
right.
And even if I go to the code, you know, I go to the DEX, I'm putting my stuff in Uniswap. I'm like, oh, hold, let me check the code. Like, I don't know what this says. So I'm going to call Richard. Richard, what does this say? I'm like, yeah. Like, I've got other things to do. I'm not going to spend my time telling you what the code is in Uniswap. So, you know, but by the same token, there are communities where they do that. But again, even that has an element of the tragedy of the commons, right? Because, you know, people are posting it and like, but unless it's like, who's paying for it and who's really doing it? Maybe you have some smart guys and because it's a vibrant ecosystem, but it kind of goes back to the point I was raising before, which is when it's less vibrant, when the money moves away, like what happens if you're like, gosh darn it, Eric keeps going back to this. So what happens if you have this like zombie like protocol? Like, and I know there's not an easy answer. Like, let's say I put a ton of money into this protocol and something bad really happens. Like, you know, it's the government cracks down and the nodes are just like, I'm out of here. This is bad news. And, you know, or maybe it's discredited or they think the likelihood of them getting repaid dissipates. Right. I guess people could just pull their money out. But what happens if all of a sudden the network nodes start to break down, where the community is so small, it's not resilient, maybe it's not secure, and people are relying on the node operators to validate those transactions, but because of the construct and because nobody ever anticipates the Black Swan event, they can't get their transaction validated to either exit or do the thing that they thought that the node operator would do for them, but hasn't. Yeah.
Well, I would say from a capital allocation perspective, when you invest in something, you need to have some kind of faith in that things will work out, right? Now, you can place the faith in a small group of people, or you could put the faith in the system, right? So I think that some projects may be just at the stage where they don't have a system in place. That's not to say they don't have working code. It's just to say their community is not sufficiently large and they have flaky nodes that would just get out of the system at a moment's notice. So in that case, then you would just have to place the faith in the people, in the small group of people that will try to do things to mend the situation. But I think going back to the broader point of how to avoid tragedy of the commons, unfortunately, we can't get rid of the following principle, which is if you want someone to do something, you have to pay for it. Now, you can pay for it implicitly or explicitly. Explicitly, for instance, with the Veed network, we just pay the full nodes, right? We say, you know, depending on your uptime, we're going to give you some rewards, okay? And, you know, in the bull market, when Veed prices are going up, it's a great deal, right? And when things are not so great, it's not such a great deal. But the implicit way of paying for things is that if people are stakeholders of a certain system, then they might find that it is helpful for them to participate by considering the greater good. Ultimately, it comes down to like a coordination problem, right? Like if you have 100 participants in the system and then each person is relying on the other 99 to do something, how do you make sure that all of them pay their share? I think governments do this by fiating, by mandating people pay their taxes or else you just go to jail, right? So I think something that could be interesting to consider is quadratic funding, which I recently came to learn about. So the way it works is that essentially you have a subsidy pool set aside, right? Going back to my principle, if you want something done, you got to pay for it. So the way it works is that if you want something done, someone goes in and tries to and makes a donation for it. But the pool that's set aside, that's generally used for public good, the way it works is that it will match the dollars for the donation. It will match the donation dollars, but it will match it in a way that is not only reflective of how much donation is put in, but also how many people support it, right? So if you have a project that has 100 donors, but each one only puts in a dollar, the quadratic funding basically says, I'm going to match more than versus another project where you only have one person that put in $100. The quadratic funding will fund, will subsidize the first project more than the second project. So I guess this is not a direct response to how do you resolve the tragedy of the commons problem. It's more of a mechanism to help incentivize people to contribute to the greater good. So once you decide, yes, I'm going to fund, for example, for Veed, right? Let's say once we decide we're going to, which is the case, we're going to pay for these nodes, then maybe we can put in some kind of mechanism that ultimately says if there's other sorts of things that we want to done on the Veed network. Let's say we want to fund a new block explorer, right? Like who's going to build it, right? Like if we're going to fund, let's say, a decentralized staking pool, right? So people want to stake, but they don't have enough money for the 1 million Veed. They want to put it in some pool. Who's going to write a program to do that? I think that maybe we can put in some kind of quadratic funding mechanism to help bring those things to fruition. Essentially help provide more support to projects that will benefit more people.
No, I mean, to me, and again, I've heard of quadratic funding, but I'm less familiar with it than you are. I don't even know if you'd say that you're,
I'm not an expert in it either.
But what I think is intriguing about it is that, you know, anytime you're funding a project, there's an inflationary component to it. And Some inflation is fine, right? So it's like, that's how you keep the network running, let's face it. And I think so what the quadratic funding, what you just described is a way of sort of ensuring that that funding is going, you know, that there is a mechanism for allocating that in a way that does maximize the greater good, but not in a way that just allows for inflation. You know, in other words, it gives a mechanism for, you know, additional tokens to be created that's going to have this benefit, and it places sort of almost self-executing controls on that. So it's really a way of capturing the greater good in a way that's, you know, all the participants can, you know, they're acknowledging it. There's that additional benefit of the token. So they're voting for this with some dollars, but then the quadratic funding also facilitates that greater good to be enjoyed by the whole network. I mean, it makes a ton of sense to me, particularly in a decentralized framework. I'll have to look into that one.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, the name's cool, but it's just like social good inflation or something, or network. And so, Richard, we've actually, you know, we're at like an hour and 5 minutes here, and I feel like we're just getting started. So before the show, you know, we were talking, we're like, yeah, we'll just get on, we'll just talk, and you know, and it, that's kind of sort of what happened. And you know, like I have notes here, like stuff that we didn't even cover, because what's interesting is like he's hit so many different issues, and he, you know, so it's there's really a lot to talk about. But
maybe we'll have these issues could take one podcast session.
Yeah, I know. So Richard, solve the world in this one podcast episode. So anyway, this was great. It was great to have you on the show. Maybe we'll have to have you back and just sort of like, you know, do another turn on some different issues and see where it goes. But thanks so much for coming on the show. So people, they want to find out about, why don't you tell us where people can find out about Veed Labs and the great blockchain debate.
Oh, okay. Great. So Veed Labs, we're on Twitter. So twitter.com/VeedLabs, VITELABS. That's the best place to find us. We have a decentralized exchange. It's called VTEX Exchange. So the Twitter handle is twitter.com/VTEX Exchange. And for me, my username on Twitter is gentso09, G-N-T-S-O-09. And the Block Debate, the Blockchain Debate podcast is at Block Debate, B-L-O-C-K-D-E-B-A-T-E on Twitter.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem, Eric. It's been great.